today's episode of the DFA Podcast. We discuss the Matt Adams trade, Doug Pfister signing, the lowly Seattle Mariners, and the holographic universe. It's the DFA Podcast. Howdy, folks. Welcome to episode 8 of the DFA Podcast. I am your host, RJ Anderson, and Ryan Grosnick is on assignment in Ethiopia tonight, so we have a special guest co-host, and you might know her from Baseball Perspectives. She's a Sabre Award winner. You might just know her as the very good pun individual on Twitter. It's Meg Rowley. Welcome to the show, Meg.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Of course. We promised Meg that she would. We wanted her on like the second after the second episode went up, and we've been holding out on her, so she gets to partake in a special episode because this is our very first night episode, and we're going to kick this one off with a very special move, which is the Atlanta Braves acquiring first baseman Matt Adams from the St. Louis Cardinals for minor leaguer Juan Yepes, and of course this was precipitated by Freddie Freeman's fractured wrist. So, Meg, why did the Braves go out and get Matt Adams instead of going with, you know, Rio Ruiz or whomever?
Well, I mean, I think that you kind of get the sense from them that they're in this odd spot. I feel like the Braves are in an odd spot generally, which is that, you know, they have this beautiful new ballpark. They're not doing particularly well, but they're not maybe in a position where they want to put like a completely unwatchable product on the field. And I think the other person that they were really considering here was Loney, right? They had him signed to a minor league deal with the idea that he'd kind of go get reps and then come up. And then, you know, they maybe saw a better option out there. And I mean, It's such an odd place for them to be because they had Freddie Freeman and everything is going to look bad in comparison to that. And so after you've accepted that into your heart, you have sort of gradations of bad. And Matt Adams is certainly, I mean, he's not lighting the world on fire or anything like that. There's a reason he was available in trade, but he hasn't been sort of a disaster. He's perfectly serviceable. He's hitting all right. So I mean, that would be sort of my take on it, which is I got this beautiful new ballpark. I got to put something on the field.
So. Right. Look at these beautiful new ballparks. But so you mentioned James Loney, and this is more of an aside than anything, but since this is a transactions podcast, I will just note that I was rooting for James Loney to get the call because right now he has 9 years and 137 days of service time. And once he hits 10 years, he will get a pension. So that's why Loney is like hanging on, you know, even though he hasn't been a productive player in a couple of years, but he's trying to hang on and get his pension. And I certainly hope he finds a team that gives him those necessary days in order to get the pension. But you're right about the Braves as well. You know, this is a team that throughout the offseason made a concentrated effort to acquire veterans who could push them closer to 500. Were they a playoff contender going into the year? No, you know, maybe they get lucky and sneak in as a second wild card team, but that doesn't seem likely at this point, especially with Freeman missing 8+ weeks. And yeah, Adams, you know, he's not stellar. Like you say, he's serviceable. He's over his last, I think it's like 500 plate appearances, 600 plate appearances. He has 22 home runs, around league average hitter. You know, he has to be platooned. The Cardinals were very aggressive in platooning him. You know, he's not really going to add a ton defensively, and his versatility is nilch. So you're going to see a interesting dilemma once Freeman comes back. Do they put Adams on the bench? Do they trade him? I don't know the answer to that question. I guess it depends on, you know, where the Braves are at that point and what Adams does until then. But I think Sean wanted to introduce another interesting subplot with this trade. Sean, you want to talk about some tweets that were out there?
I don't know if any of you viewers or anybody else is on Twitter and takes part in the Ask Copy Braves Twitter segment that he likes to do every now and then, but it certainly seemed like Copy loves his Freddie Freeman, loves him very much, and it went so far as to call the first base absence that Freeman has left a void. When one person asked how will the team overcome Freddie's absence, just flat out saying we can't, we signed James Loney and we will continue to explore the trade market before they eventually traded for Matt Adams. What do you guys think of a GM who's this openly loving of a cornerstone of that franchise?
I have mixed feelings here because, on the one hand, is it refreshing to see a general manager just be blunt about it? Yes. On the other hand, I can see how this would rub not only his team the wrong way, but other teams as well. You know, he had that tweet during the offseason, like, where he was like openly coveting Chris Archer, and that's like borderline tampering in a sense. So I like that he's, you know, kind of honest about, well, you know, this isn't good. I don't know that. I mean, there's a lot of these tweets. I mean, Sean, you gathered and sent them out, and there was like five or six of the tweets to this effect where he's like bemoaning the loss of Freeman. And it's totally understandable. You know, Freeman was arguably, you know, the best hitter in baseball. He had like a .341 batting average, .461 on base, .748 slugging. You know, you're not gonna replace him. You're not gonna come close to replacing him, especially not with anything that's available on the trade market in, you know, mid-May. That said, yeah, I think there's a point where it kind of gets a little annoying if you're, you know, a member of the Atlanta Braves, if you're Tyler Flowers or Matt Kemp or whomever, you don't really want to hear your general manager, hear about your general manager tweeting these things where it's like, yeah, we're toast. What do you think, Nick?
So I was surprised that the tone of them sort of leaned in the direction of, so I could understand if he was going to want to sort of talk about Freeman and the role that he played on that club and how much they're going to miss him. And I do wonder how much of those tweets were sort of tongue in cheek, because they do tend toward the absurd. I mean, he's talking about Frozen in them too. So it's not as if they're necessarily meant to be super serious, but it is a weird signal to send to your club, that you're basically acknowledging that you guys aren't going to be able to get anywhere if Freeman doesn't come back soon. On the other hand, that's a pretty honest assessment, right? Like, he is driving that offense. He's not the only one who's hitting, but like, he's driving that offense, and he's certainly at a moment when they are navigating this transition from one iteration of the Braves to a newer iteration of the Braves, this really important constant. And I think that, players know better than anyone kind of what the reality of their situation is and the reality of their team. And when he does those Twitter Q&As, I tend to read them as not being, as being mostly directed at his fans, right? And so if you saw Braves Twitter after Freeman went down with that wrist injury, like they set the city on fire, right? And so I think you have to, as a GM, sort of have that communication with your fan base and acknowledge the loss, because saying, we got a bunch of great guys and they're going to soldier through without acknowledging that they're going to soldier through minus a guy who is, having another breakout season and is, kind of going to be in the MVP conversation, even if he's unlikely to win given some of the other guys who are at the top of the leaderboard, is sort of disingenuous. So I don't know. I like it when GMs are honest. I think that anything less than that is sort of bizarre, because the guys in the clubhouse know what the situation is. I don't think Matt Kemp is walking around saying, "I am as indispensable to the Atlanta Braves as Freddie Freeman." Like, I doubt that strongly. So I don't know. I think we tend to worry a bit too much about how those guys are going to get their noses bent out of joint, because I'm sure he's already upset that he's not as good as Freddie.
That's fair. And maybe we're so used to executive prattle that statements like these are seemingly out of place when, I mean, you know, Sandy Alderson has made some comments that seem out of place too, but I think we're just so used to like the homogeneous executive template now where they give you 300 word responses and there's like zero, you know, zero interesting information or new information provided. It's just, you know, cliches and dressed up cliches and couched comments. So yeah, that's certainly fair. We're going to transition now to a different kind of transaction that involved a different kind of signal from a general manager, and we're going to talk about the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Billy Epler had an interesting offseason. He went out and acquired a bunch of short-term veteran options who, frankly, can be labeled as mediocre or average, and the idea was basically to surround Mike Trout with a better supporting cast, albeit not a great supporting cast, but a cheap supporting cast that could perhaps flirt with 500, maybe a little bit better, depending on, what they got from Danny Espinosa, what they got from Cameron Maven, and so on and so forth. And the Angels kind of continued that theme recently by signing Doug Fister to a big league deal. He is going to the minors to prepare, presumably to slot into Alex Meyer's rotation spot. So, Meg, as of this recording, the Angels are in third place. They're 7 games back of the Astros. They're a game back of the Rangers. Do you like the decision to sign Fister?
Well, you have to have somebody go out there and throw. I mean, the sort of scope of the magnitude of the injuries that they've had to that rotation is pretty severe, and it wasn't exactly in a position where it was going to light the world on fire before guys got hurt. I wrote the Angels essay for the BP annual this year, and they are having to sort of grapple with the reality of the fact that they have not put a winning team around Mike Trout. And I think a lot has been made in the last couple of days of sort of the disparity on the offensive side between what Mike Trout is producing versus what the rest of the team is producing. But they're only a game out of the second wild card. I mean, it's only May, but they're doing surprisingly well considering where I think a lot of us thought they were going to be going into the season. And I think that Trout is such a remarkable player that if you put a reasonably competent cast of characters around him, we can kind of go see what this Angels team is capable of. I doubt strongly that they're going to be hanging around at the end of the season in sort of that wild card conversation, but a really good way to make sure they're not doing that is trying to address the pitching in the short term while some of these guys are, hopefully going to come back and get healthy. And it was always weird to me that Fister was still out there. I mean, Fister did not have a good 2016. I think, I'm looking at his baseball prospectus page. He ran like a 5.65 DRA. He had a 4.70 FIP. Like he wasn't a particularly effective pitcher, but he's serviceable. And the fact that, he was sitting on the couch while like the Padres existed always struck me as kind of weird. And so on the one hand, like, is this a great signing? I mean, no, because he's not a great pitcher, but it's fine. And they're really just trying to fill innings until some of these other guys come back healthy. So I think that, for what they're, I don't recall what the deal was worth, but it's not like they're paying him a ton of money. And if they're going to have any hope of sort of continuing to keep pace in the AL wildcard race, obviously the division is out of reach for them, with the Astros playing the way that they are. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Just to follow up what you said, at minimum, Fister would appear to be an upgrade over Meyer, who through 5 starts has walked 7 batters per 9, and he's striking out batters, but you can't continue to do that and succeed or even come close to succeeding in the rotation. And the thing about Fister, you mentioned how it's a little bizarre that he was still available at this point. It seems like he's always been undervalued or underrated or, whatever word you want to use, because, he came up, I think he was like in his mid-20s by the time he reached the majors with Seattle. He was 26 when he finally got like a full-time spot in the rotation. And then, obviously the trade to Detroit, everyone was like, that wasn't a really big price they paid. And then, Detroit traded him to Washington for barely any more than what they received. Excuse me, what they gave up to get Fister in the first place. And, then he signed that 1-year deal with Houston. And yeah, he's an interesting pitcher. He's obviously a finesse guy, but if you look at his velocity, Brooks Baseball has him gaining velocity last year as opposed to losing it, which he had done in recent seasons. He's not going to miss bats. That's not his game. He's really, the home run rate has gone up and he's hittable, and realistically, is he more than a number five option? No, but when you don't have a legitimate number five option, to fill out your rotation, then yes, he looks like he could be an upgrade, not a huge upgrade, and he's not certainly not going to be a difference maker. But those marginal upgrades, this is an area where the Angels, I don't want to say excel, but they're seemingly doing a pretty solid job of finding, not diamonds even in the rough, but just marginal upgrades. Like for instance, JC Ramirez. Nobody would thought JC Ramirez was going to be an effective starting pitcher, but you look at his numbers, I think he has the best ERA plus in the rotation. And you add in, I mean, Ricky Nolasco has been better than anyone expected, and Jesse Chavez hasn't been great, but he hasn't been so horrible that you remove him from the rotation. Bud Norris is excelling as a closer, and Pettitte has been perfectly good, and Blake Parker, I think people might remember him from the Cubs a few years back. But that, again, that's not someone you expected to succeed. David Hernandez was literally like lifted from another team's farm system. He's been very good in 11 innings. So, Billy Epler has shown some aptitude for finding cheap help. And Fister, is he likely to be more than like a number five, a below average starter? No, but that seems to be a continuation of a theme that began in the offseason and has carried forth through the season and through a solid start from an Angels team. Again, not that far out of the wild card race. So even though I certainly wouldn't predict that they will reach the playoffs, and Meg, I'm guessing you wouldn't either, correct?
No,
Yeah,
no.
so even though we're not necessarily sold on them, there's a reason they play the games, and maybe they find enough marginal upgrades. And Mike Trout carries them on his back. Maybe Albert Pujols, becomes the Albert Pujols of old. It's not likely at all, but who knows? Cole Calhoun cannot continue to play this bad, you wouldn't think. And
Yeah.
Danny Espinosa has to play better. Of course, on the flip side, is Martin Maldonado really this good? I don't know, but it's an interesting strategy, and it's one that I applaud. I like it when teams that maybe don't look like competitors on paper, but have, Mike Trout and have Cole Calhoun and, had obviously Garrett Richards, is out, but, had Garrett Richards. I think when teams that have solid to good cores go for it instead of just hitting the reset button and trading off all their veteran parts and wasting, a chance to join the race instead of just running on the treadmill for another 2, 3, 4 years. So I applaud that, even if I don't think it's necessarily going to result in a playoff appearance.
Yeah, I mean it's like I said in my essay for BP. It's like once you have one Mike Trout, you have problems because the expectation is that you're gonna do something with that. And so even if this move doesn't push them into the territory of being a legitimate contender in the AL, even though, as you said, they do have some pieces that are sort of working better than we would necessarily expect them to, I think there's value in being able to say to your fan base, we're not throwing in the towel in May and just accepting that this is going to be bad. Now, the hyper frenzied version of that is DePoto, and then you kind of wonder like what's actually going on
Right.
and how useful any of it's being. So like there is a point at which that stops being enough, certainly. But I think that it's good to be able to say to your fan base, we're going to keep trying stuff and see if we can make this work a little longer. And I think there's a lot of value in that.
I absolutely agree. So we're talking about the Angels, and I think it's time to move on to what we call the batting practice segment. We're going to bring in our producer, Mr. Sean Brody. And Brody, what do you have for us tonight?
So I have some more Angels stuff for you. The Los Angeles Angels called up Nolan Fontana for his first cup of tea in the big leagues, and they optioned down CJ Cron for him. Fontana, the guy who had a high walk rate for a lot of his career in the minor leagues, really, really struggled last year. Batted 195 with a 268 OBP and 262 slugging percentage. He's a former second round pick. Do we believe there's anything there? And also, CJ Cron going to the minor leagues, has he really fallen off that much?
Just to address Fontana, I'm always kind of skeptical about high walk rates in the minors when they aren't accompanied by a great hit tool or a lot of power, because my fear is that once you reach the majors, pitchers are just going to, pound you with fastballs and test your ability to hit for enough average or hit for enough power to make them do anything different. And, the guy I always compare here is like the guys I always compare these players to, excuse me, are they Sam Fold or are they Brett Gardner? Because, Brett Gardner's obviously had a successful career. Samfold had a decent career as, a reserve outfielder. It was short, but, it was decent. That's a decent career path to take. I'm guessing Fontana is more Fold here. To his credit, he reached base 37% of the time this season in AAA, but I don't expect him to be a sensation or anything. And as for Crone, he has struggled this year, and this is a team that has, Pujols. It has Jeffrey Marte, who had a decent season last year, not so much this year, but he is out hitting Crone, albeit barely. They signed Luis Valbuena. So I don't know. He's older than you think he is too. He's already 20. This is his age 27 season. I think if you're thinking CJ Crone, you're thinking he's like mid-20s, but he's not. And I don't know. I really don't think that he's this bad, but I'm also not sure that he's more than a slightly above average right-handed option at a corner infield position. So I don't know. What about you, Meg?
I think his name sounds like someone who's in a Rascal Flatts cover band. That's what I think of when I think of CJ Cron. I mean, I don't really have a lot to add. He's not hit well. He's not exactly lighting the world on fire, I think, given the other sort of bad aging bets that they have. Even though you're right, on the one hand, he feels like he's much younger, and on the other hand, I feel like I've been watching him try to hit against the Mariners for like 15 years. So,
As we
oh.
learned, though, from the fantasy write-ups on BP, we're all just holograms of one larger CJ Crone. So maybe that's the effect that's led us to believe he's been around forever.
Yeah, no kidding.
We move forward to Jared Weaver, a former Angel.
Speaking of people who've been around forever,
And this guy is on the 10-day disabled list with left hip inflammation. So I ask you guys this: what is higher, his DRA minus or his strikeout totals for the last 3 seasons?
Oh man.
You wouldn't ask this if it wasn't the DRA minus.
It is a DRA minus. He has a 258 DRA minus, and that of course comes from an 11.83 DRA.
Moses. I'm like just now grappling with Jared Weaver's season. Like I knew it was not going well for him in San Diego. You don't have a good start to things and have your GM be like, well, this isn't what we expected or wanted from someone. Like that's a thing that people don't say in public unless you're doing really poorly. But good golly, this is terrible. How are you worth negative 3.1 warp? It's the middle of May. It's the middle of May.
Yeah, and just to address some of his traditional statistics, he has a 7.44 ERA in 9 starts, only 42 innings. He's given up 51 hits, 41 runs, 16 home runs. He is literally giving up a home run more than every 3 innings, which is amazing. And like you said, like the Padres management has been openly critical about him. I'm not sure what they were expecting, though. This is an individual who, over the last 2 seasons, even while pitching with the Angels in that ballpark that supposedly is, built for his release point, his crossfire delivery, he had 81 ERA plus, and he had 80 ERA plus. Home runs were an issue. He was hittable. He's obviously not going to miss bats. So moving to Petco, I understand the idea, like he's going to benefit from the bigger dimensions, but he already had a ballpark that was very favorable to him, and he was horrible. So I don't really know what they anticipated from Weaver, but I would say he's somehow found a way to go below those expectations, which is amazing to me. And I'm really curious how many more starts they give him, because we're nearing a point where like this could be a historically awful season if he gets enough starts. Like, 9 starts to me is not enough where I'm necessarily going to remember it in 5 to 10 years. So I guess I'll just ask this: how many starts does Jared Weaver need before we start talking about this as the worst pitching season of all time?
This number is gonna feel too low, but I have a justification. I think it's like two more, which isn't going to be fully fair to him because I think to make that case in a way that is intellectually rigorous, we probably need, I don't know, four or five that look the same way. But I think that we have reached a point where our expectations of him are so low And he has already endured 9 starts of this, you know, that I think that if he goes out there 1 or 2 more times and just gets absolutely shelled, I don't know, the extent of the decline is such that I just don't see how we talk about it in any sort of different way. And it's sort of a bummer because there's something interesting about a human being electing to keep doing this thing when he obviously had such a terrible year last year. But man, can I tell you my one fun? It's not fun. It's weird. It's not that weird. It's weird mostly to me. Jared Weaver fact.
It is.
RJ, I think you've heard this before. So Jared Weaver was the only qualified pitcher on the in terms of innings on the Angels last year because their rotation was just riddled with injuries. And he was obviously playing for the Angels, which is a division rival of the Mariners. And they managed to not ever get a Jared Weaver start.
Yeah, that amazed me.
They didn't see him, which seems like it's very unlikely.
That's got to be the reason they missed the playoffs, right?
That's a great
point. Because of Jared Weaver.
I've had that thought maybe once a month since the season ended last year. So, yes. And they've switched the natural, like, the interleague rivals for the Mariners. It used to be the Padres, and now it's the Rockies. So they won't see him at all this year.
Wow.
And moving on from one pitcher that is on the disabled list to a man that is sent down, that's Anibal Sanchez. He has been optioned to the Toledo Mudhens from the Detroit Tigers. So what has gone wrong with Anibal Sanchez?
Everything. You know, obviously he used to be a very, very good pitcher. He was in the Cy Young. He was like top 5 finisher in Cy Young in 2013. Had a decent 2014, albeit sort of, you know, shortened by injuries. And since then, he has been horrid. And, you know, entering the spring, there's some renewed optimism about him because he had reworked his mechanics, and we were saying, you know what, 33 isn't that old, and, you know, he still had a decent strikeout to walk ratio, and the idea was, you know, if he just becomes a little less hittable, maybe there's a back end starter still hiding in there. And yeah, there's not a back end starter hiding in there, because in 11 relief appearances, 21 innings, he's given up 34 hits, 26 runs, 9 home runs. You know, that's a higher home run rate, excuse me, than Jared Weaver, who we just got done completely mocking for his hitability. So, you know, Sanchez he's only 33, but I think his days are about over as a productive big league pitcher, and I think his days as a big league pitcher are about over, period. He does have a team option for next season, but it would not surprise me too much if we have seen the last of him with the Detroit Tigers.
How many of those home runs have come at Comerica?
3 of the home runs have been at Comerica.
So it could be worse insofar as, like, he could have given them all up at Comerica, which is not always an easy place to hit a home run, but wow. Anibal, what happened to you? What happened to you, man? These guys bum me out mostly because, you know, Jared Weaver and Sanchez to a lesser degree, but, like, he feels, in terms of how long I've been watching him play baseball, and, you know, he's tall, and I always think people who are tall are older than they are. He's only 34. Yeah. Like, as a human being, that is not an old person. That is a still young and vital person, I say, as someone who's about to turn 31 in a month. So, like, the idea that they are, you know, just fallen off a cliff and will never sort of reach the same professional heights again. This is not a new thought, but it's one that has been particularly resonant to me as we've seen some of these guys who, you know, they were young not that long ago, and now they are pretty bad at baseball. And I just sit here and think about what the baseball writer aging curve is like, and I don't think we have a great answer, but it makes me worry. Me nervous.
Sanchez was really good in the first 2 years of that deal with the Tigers, too.
Yeah, he was.
Just these last 3 seasons, like, when he's past 30, he has just fallen off a cliff.
Yeah.
And injuries, you know, I don't think we have a good grasp on what the, like, accumulative effect of a bunch of injuries can do to a pitcher or any player. And maybe he's just someone who, you know, the injuries kept adding up and his body just cannot take it anymore. And it led to the skill decay beyond our expectations, you know, a quicker skill decay than what we expected. So it's unfortunate because, again, it wasn't too long ago we were talking about him not only as like a legitimate Cy Young candidate, but arguably one of the top, what, five or six pitchers in the American League. And now he not only deserves a roster spot, like you can argue he doesn't deserve to even be on a minor league roster because, like, you know, what's left? He's already changed his mechanics and changed his arm slot and everything, and that didn't lead to any improved results. It led to worse results. So what is there he can do? You know, he's not going to take up throwing a knuckleball. So I think we may have seen the last of Hannibal Sanchez in the regular season. It wouldn't surprise me if he gets like a non-roster invite with some rebuilding team next year. So basically what I'm saying is Hannibal Sanchez, he's either the Padres or he's completely out of Major League Baseball in like 12 months' time.
Hannibal Sanchez, Los Angeles Angel. Coming soon to a ballpark near you.
He might actually go there and succeed based on some of their recent pickups, so you never know.
It was only 2013 when he finished fourth in Cy Young voting. He led baseball in ERA plus in FIP. I mean,
that's not long ago.
It's not that long ago.
Less than 4 years, and now he is completely. He's probably done. So that's humbling. I have the
same car now that I had then. Same car. That runs better than Annabelle Sanchez did.
Probably faster than any Jared Weaver fastball. For 2018, Annabelle Sanchez, he has a $16 million team option with a $5 million buyout. Has there ever been a buyout that big that seems like it's going to happen no matter what?
I don't know offhand, but I'm sure there's been one, an equivalent buyout. I mean, to have been. $5 million is, you know, that's definitely a decent chunk of change, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was definitely a bigger one. Just nothing is springing to mind right now.
So we'll keep going forward from depressing pitcher to Al Albuquerque, Al outrighted to the Omaha Storm Chasers from the Kansas City Royals. And I mentioned this before we started recording, but I had zero idea Al Albuquerque was still in professional baseball. Did either of you?
Yeah, I actually knew because I remember stumbling upon him like a week ago when I was looking at the Royals death chart. But, you know, there's a little bit of synergy here. Former Detroit Tiger, former Los Angeles Angel. So see, we tied those together pretty well. You know, he's always been wild and he remains wild, but, you know, he just didn't get it done with the Royals. I will say, like, he's younger than you expect. We talk about CJ Cron being older than you expect. Albuquerque is only 31 years old. And again, it wasn't that long ago. He was a member of those Detroit Tiger teams that were really good, and he was really good. Even now, he has a career ERA plus of a 125, a career strikeout rate of 11 per 9. Again, he's always been wild. You don't sign Al Albuquerque if you're expecting great command, but it wouldn't surprise me if he pops back up. Maybe not right away. Maybe he's a September call-up, but I think he's probably going to get another shot in the majors, at least one more. What do you think, Meg?
I mean, probably. He's, like you said, he's not that old, and he's managed to stick it out this long, which is, you know, I thought for a while, like you, that he was sort of out of baseball, though he did make a, if I remember correctly, sort of make a minor league run through the Mariner system last year, sort of org depth. So, I don't know. We'll see. I guess it'll kind of depend how he pitches in Omaha.
Yeah, and that Royals bullpen is an interesting mix of, like, famous names. I mean, Mike Minor has been outstanding. Joaquin Soria has been very good. You know, those are two guys you know from the past, and they've been very good. And then you have, like, Travis Wood and Pierre Moylan. Again, two names you know. They both have ERAs over 9 and 15-plus innings. Their strikeout-to-walk ratios are 0.73 and 1.5. So that's not good. And, you know, Chris Young has gotten a couple of starts, but he hasn't been great from traditional statistics viewpoint. Or, you know, even his FIP is 6.12. And even though, you know, he's always been kind of underrated by fielding independent pitching and metrics of that type, you know, that's ugly. And then they have Seth Maness, who has a very interesting backstory. He's a few appearances into the season, actually already has more innings than Albuquerque had. And, you know, he's kind of had a mixed bag, a good strikeout to walk ratio, but he's been very hittable. So it's a very interesting collection of arms in Kansas City. And, you know, it's sort of working in the sense that there are a few success stories who are probably going to get traded at the deadline. But overall, that Royals team is in last place, and it looks like it's going to be a disappointing summer. for the Royals, much as it's been a disappointing spring in the summer for Albuquerque.
Yeah, but they want to lose, right? At this point, it's good for them. It makes choices easier.
That's fair. I feel like it's a medicinal take there. Like, it's good for them because, you know, it's not great. It's hard, so it must be good for them. I don't know. I mean, you're right. It does make it easier to perhaps trade some of these pending free agents, trade some of these guys who have been, like, the heartbeat of championship teams and, you know, a pennant-winning team. But I don't think anyone necessarily wants to lose. But I do get what you're saying, yeah, that it makes decisions easier to sell to ownership, to the fan base, maybe even to themselves. Because, you know, Kansas City, remember even last winter, like, they were committed to giving this group one more run. You know, they were committed to not tearing it down. And they, you know, they did make some moves during the winter, trading Wade Davis. But, yeah, I suppose that's sort of the silver lining there, that they're going to probably be more aggressive in selling. And maybe they beat Evers to the punch and they get slightly better package, or at least they match up with a farm system they like more than other teams do by virtue of being the first on the market. So we'll see. Hopefully better days are ahead for them, and hopefully for Al Albuquerque.
Yeah.
From Al Albuquerque, we now go to the Seattle Mariners, who optioned Tuffy Goswich to the minor league, called up Dan Vogelback for I think a game, and then sent him back down.
Yeah.
And then called up Mike Zunino. So Meg, this is your niche. Have at it.
So I'm going to confess to something, which is that there are days when I will get busy at work and, you know, my day job is sadly not writing about baseball, and I will I'll look around and I'll turn on a Mariners game at night and I will be surprised by who is on the field. And that is, you know, in some ways a testament to being busy at work, but is in a lot of ways a testament to the fact that this team has made, think approximately 70,000 moves since the season started. I sort of feel bad that we have not just carved out a dedicated Mariners transaction beat in our transaction analysis team, just so that people don't have to keep writing about my terrible Mariners. I mean, Tuffy Goswich, I think, had one hit as a Mariner. Like, he's played more than one game, so that's pretty bad. That's the sort of thing that you remember. Like, you sit there and you think, are the puns going to save me from Tuffy Goswich? Is it going to be enough to make me feel better? And then you realize, no, it's not. Oh, he has two. Never mind. I take it all back. He's doing great. So Tuffy was up just to sort of stay and spell Mike Zunino, who once again had to go down to Tacoma to sort of figure out his bat. So he is back up because while he has been bad and inconsistent, he is definitely better than Tuffy Goswich. So he is here. He hit a home run in a very bad Mariners loss against the Nationals the evening we're recording this. So he has, continues to be confusing and not as good at baseball as we'd hope he would be. And then Vogelback, I don't think that we'll see him back again for a little while. That call-up was just because Danny Valencia sort of tweaked his wrist, and they didn't think he was going to be able to go, and he wasn't able to play, and he actually ended up getting scratched from his start today, and I think Taylor Motter played for him. So it'll kind of depend on what Valencia's health looks like over the next little bit, but Valencia's, after a very rough start to the season, has sort of turned his bat around and has been hitting much better. And Vogelback was really struggling at the major league level. And so I think they're inclined, at least from what the front office has said publicly, to sort of let Vogelback have whatever time he needs to figure stuff out in Tacoma and get his swing right and sort of get where he needs to be. So I don't imagine we'll see him back up again unless something is really serious with Valencia's wrist and he's going to be out for an extended period. Meanwhile, Adam Lind is like lighting the world on fire in limited opportunities for the Nationals. So the Mariners continue to just never be able to time first base quite right. But
I think for your mental health, if we continue with this section. So Brody, give us the next move.
So from the West Coast to the East Coast, Sam Travis called up for the Boston Red Sox, batting .286 with a .353 on base percentage and a .452 slugging percentage.
You know, he's an interesting player. He was a college teammate of Kyle Schwarber, which, you know, naturally put extra eyes on him. The scouting report BP posted today basically said he has the potential to be a second division regular. So you're looking at someone who's really contact oriented. And here's the bad thing. Like, I hear Sam Travis and I hear, excuse me, I read, the report, and I keep thinking like Travis Lee because of the name thing, and I can't shake that out of my head. And if you make me think of Travis Lee, I'm like naturally inclined to think you're not going to be able to fill any void. However, why not give him a shot at this point? And it's interesting that this call up comes. We just heard rumors, what, like 3 days ago, 2 days ago, about the Red Sox potentially scouting Todd Frazier. So, it's interesting timing that they would bring him up literally days later. Maybe they're going to get a look at him, see what they have there before potentially hitting the trade market. But, this is not a situation where the Red Sox are calling up like an uber prospect. They're calling up someone who has a modest ceiling and a skill set that's kind of easy to, I would say, underrate, because a lot of times if you're a right-handed hitting corner infielder and you don't have great power, it's going to be hard to stand out, especially if you're not projected to hit 300 plus. So I don't know. I'm interested to see what he does, but
Can I share another sad Mariners fact? Just because I was looking it up while you were talking about this. So this is as of May 16th. As of May 16th. So the number may have changed a little bit since then. I will admit to bowing out early from some of the White Sox blowouts over the weekend. But as of May 16th, the Mariners had used 24 different pitchers and 17 position players. That seems like a lot, you guys. That seems like too many. That seems like everyone's dead. Like that's what happens when you have like a zombie rotation on the disabled list. So, anyway, fun facts from Mariners land. We're all very sad. We're sort of used to it, but now we're sad and maybe a little let down.
Meg is just compared the zombies here. We need Brian back because see, when Brian's around, I'm the kookiest one. Now she's bringing up the zombie situation, so she's trying to steal my position here. Meg, I'm on to you, and I will counter here by making a ghost reference like any second now. So give me something to do here, Sean. Give me a what's next?
So just finishing off the Sam Travis talk, I've wanted to get Jed Lowry into this show every time we've recorded, and I hope that the Red Sox trade for Jed Lowry and put him at third base, a position he has not played since 2015. But I have an irrational love for Jed Lowry, and I hope that he finds his way back to Boston. Anyway, Brian McCann placed on the 7-day disabled list. He had a concussion the other day. He has been hitting very well this season, slugging 455 to this point, getting on base about 36, 37% of the time. So how do they cope for the time being, the best team in the American League, and I believe baseball in general?
Here's the thing. They're going to be fine. They're going to be annoyingly fine. Like,
Let's be honest.
they're
They're
going to
gonna
be
be
fine.
fine.
I mean, obviously, McCann's been having a great season. I think they're incredibly happy with sort of where he's at and what he's contributed. It was a position they needed to shore up, and they've done that. And I think they feel great. And I think that a team that has won, what, 30 games? At this point,
Yes.
right? They're at
30 and
30.
15.
Yeah, I think they're gonna be fine, and they'll put Gattis at catcher, which he's been sort of filling in for McCann on McCann's off days, and they have somebody else behind him whose name is escaping me right now. And Gattis will probably hit a big home run because it's the Astros and they're pretty good at baseball right now, and that seems to be how the AL West is moving, and they're gonna be fine.
Yeah, and I thought it was a smart trade to get him during the winter.
Yeah.
I understood why the Yankees moved him, Gary Sanchez, but I thought McCann was a little underrated because even if you accepted that his bat had declined from his days with the Braves where he made like, I don't know, it was like six straight All-Star teams or whatever, to get a guy who's basically a league average hitter and a good framer, he's supposedly good with handling a staff. I know he's not a great thrower, but that stuff is sort of minimized, and that's dependent on your pitching staff anyway. So I thought it was really smart to go out and get him, even though he's entering his mid-30s, and there is some attrition risk there with the skill set. But I guess the only thing I can really say here is besides, they're going to be fine, is that it does kind of stink that they're missing him and Dallas Keuchel at the same time.
Yeah.
That's an underrated development there, but they have such a big lead. And what I find interesting here, and this has less to do with McCann than his injury, is that we actually have a catcher here going on the disabled list with a concussion. I've always wanted to do this piece on like how absurd it is that we never hear about more catchers having concussions more often. And there was this time where I did, BP had the injury database and I looked it up, and I don't have the results right in front of me, but I seem to remember more pitchers going on the disabled list with concussions or concussion-like symptoms than catchers. And to me, that is absolutely absurd, and it speaks that there is a issue of reporting or diagnosing concussions in baseball, particularly from catchers, because, I mean, I remember Jose Molina. He was like the least mobile backstop behind the plate, and every single night he was getting hit in the helmet with at least one foul tip, at least one, and not one single time do I recall him leaving a game or going on the disabled list with a concussion, or even reporting, like even a reporter noting that, oh, he had concussion-like symptoms, and that is absurd to me. So obviously, I don't want Brian McCann to have a concussion, but in a sense, it's kind of a relief that he reported it or they diagnosed it, and he's going to get some time off to recover from the concussion. Because I guess I'm just concerned that there's a lot of catchers out there who do not report these things, who have concussions go undiagnosed, and it makes me concerned for their long-term well-being. So, do not want to see anyone get a concussion, but I'm relieved that his concussion was diagnosed and that he's going to be shut down for a little while and make a full recovery instead of rushing back out there and perhaps suffering even more damage in the short term and, of course, worsening his health for the long term. But yeah,
Yeah,
the Astros are going to be fine.
they're gonna be okay. I mean, I think that it's interesting. I think you're right that and this is, I mean, it may well be just coincidence, but it does seem as if I'm over at a baseball keep sort of looking at some of the DL stuff this year. And I will admit to not knowing. I'd have to go back and sort of look how this compares over prior years, but in terms of catchers on the DL, it looks like Hector Sanchez did that. Buster Posey was on there earlier for the Giants this year. Tony Walters, Vegeli for the A's. Iannetta went on the DL when he got beamed in the face, which was very scary. Glad you're feeling better, Chris. And then McCann. So yeah, it does seem like there's been we're sort of running ahead of our typical rate, at least on the catcher front,
Yeah.
from years prior. So yeah, it's interesting. I'm a little surprised. You know, you expect more DL stints this year just generally because of the 10-day, but obviously the 7-day concussion protocol is separate and has been around since what, 2011? So I'm sure it's just a coincidence that we're sort of seeing that tick up compared to prior years, but it is nice that they are seemingly taking that seriously and not monkeying around with guys' health because we've seen, you know, other sports that have sort of have neglected the long-term view on that for players, and it can be really devastating. So glad that they're taking it seriously, or at least as far as we know. And I'm looking, it looks like McCann expects to be back when his DL stint is up on Saturday. So they will get him back in short order.
Give us something uplifting here, Brody.
Well, if you want uplifting, I have a downward movement for you. Julio Urias sent down
Womp,
for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
womp. Well, you gotta remember, like, he was brought up in part because some injuries had happened with him, and he was really bad the last few times out. His pitch count, we're talking about him early May. He had that near no-hitter against the Pirates. When I say near no-hitter, I mean, he had carried a no-hitter through 6+ innings. And then in the two starts since then, he recorded as many outs as he did in that one game, but he gave up 14 hits, 13 runs, 4 walks. He struck out one batter. He allowed one home run and hit a batter. That's horrendous. And the Dodgers are going to play the shell game with their starting pitchers all year. We've already seen it with Rich Hill and Kenta Maeda. This doesn't necessarily feel like the shell game. This feels like they're sending him down because his performance had been poor. And yeah, they do want to cap his innings. But this feels less like a outright roster manipulation and more like some legitimate concern about how poor he had pitched recently.
Yeah, it sounds like they want to sort of give him an opportunity to get right and sort of fix whatever's ailing him because you're right, he was, you know, pitching really well before that that really disastrous start. So it could be as simple as he gets a start or two under his belt and then comes back and is there until the next guy goes on the disabled list or gets sent down. But I agree. I think this has a slightly different feel than some of their other roster moves of late. So.
And this has to be like the worst case scenario if you're the Dodgers, because you want to limit his workload. But at the same time, right now, like, do you really want to send him down and, play with his innings? Or do you want to keep his confidence high by sending him out there and saying, you know what, we have confidence that you're going to rejoin the rotation in short order, so we're going to continue to treat you like, you're literally a call away from the majors. So I feel like you couldn't have scripted a worse scenario for the Dodgers, because if he had finished on a high note, these answers are a little easier to come up with. And now, I mean, for his sake, I hope he pitches well and I hope he gets back on track. But it's a rotten situation, and it's a complicated situation to begin with, and this certainly makes it a little bit more complicated, which is never a good thing.
So moving on now to a former Seattle Mariner, Taijuan Walker, on the 10-day disabled list with a blister in his right index finger. It's retroactive to May 20th. The Diamondbacks have been really good this season. They suffered the Shelby Miller torn UCL earlier in the year, so Zach Godley came up for that and has been doing very well for them. And for the Walker injury, they've put Randall Delgado in the rotation, who has pitched very well this season. But has not started a game since August 22nd of 2015. So will Delgado be the answer if Walker needs more time?
Probably not, but here's the thing. I find it interesting that they went with Delgado into the rotation instead of potentially moving Archie Bradley to the rotation. And we talked about the Bradley situation before, how he has effectively been their best reliever. And they have Jorge De La Rosa. He's been performing well. J.J. Hoover's been a little iffy with his command, but the strikeouts are there. And Andrew Chafin has also gotten some good results. So yeah, it's interesting to me that they would move Delgado instead of Bradley, and I wonder what that says about not just like their opinion on potentially moving Bradley back to the rotation, but their opinion about his potential to do it in season. I wonder if they're going to keep him in the bullpen for this season and perhaps phase him back into the rotation next spring, or I wonder if they've just decided, you know what, he's a reliever, we're going to keep him there. He's doing a really good job, a really outstanding job. And by the end of the season, he's going to be closing games for us. So that's the most interesting part of this to me. And, it's unfortunate because the Diamondbacks, like you said, have really gotten off to a very good start. And, to lose Shelby Miller, I know Walker's injury is a short-term one, but it stinks because this is not a team that's really all that well prepared to deal with these kind of injuries, especially if they pile up. So, God forbid one of these ever Arizona Diamondback pitchers suffer an injury, they're going to be stretching to bring up Shipley or to bring up Banda. And it's unfortunate again because this team has really gotten off to an impressive start, and you kind of hope it continues because it's fun when these teams just sort of pop up and have competitive years out of nowhere,
Yeah, I guess it is encouraging that it's, I mean, we have seen that blisters can be persistent and they can be a problem, even beyond sort of the normal 10-day stint. But I mean, in my memory of Taijuan in Seattle, that was never a problem. He never had a year like Rich Hill had last year where he had blisters all the time. His injury history has always been around his feet and his ankles and sort of the issues that that brings up with being able to plant the way he wants. So this is sort of a new problem for him, which isn't great, but also isn't part of a larger pattern. So I think it'll be interesting to see how long he really takes to recover from that. But yeah, he's having a nice little year, which, he's one of those rare players where the Mariners side of this trade as a fan is working out fine. Like Jean Segura is hitting the ball really well. Mitch Haniger is on the disabled list because he plays for the Seattle Mariners, but was doing really, really well and sort of exceeding my expectations, certainly, before he got hurt and is about to come back. And so it's one of those weird trades where you're like, everyone can just be happy. I mean, it would be nice to have more pitching in Seattle, but I'm happy for Ty. I hope he comes back soon and keeps pitching well, because like you said, it's nice when teams come out of nowhere and surprise you, and it's even better when that happens in the National League as an AL fan. Works out great.
So two more bullet points for you. Phil Hughes on the 10-day disabled list with right bicep tendon inflammation. They sent him for an MRI earlier today. How sad is it to see the way Phil Hughes has really struggled with injuries these last few seasons? Because he seems, from all intents and purposes, like an all-around guy, just a very good character and one of my personal favorites to watch.
The corresponding move here was to bring back Kyle Gibson, who we talked about recently. He's been so disappointing. That Gibson, that is, not Hughes. And I do hope that Hughes comes back and comes back strong, because I thought his one season, a few years ago, was really, really fun to watch. And I remember them signing him to this extension, then we all kind of questioned it, because you're banking on this late career. And it really wasn't that late in his career. He was like 28, but you were banking on this huge change in performance. And since then, it hasn't been there. His strikeout to walk ratio that one season was over 11. And since then, I think if you add up his strikeout to walk ratios for the last two plus seasons, I don't even think they equal. I do think they equal 10. I don't think they equal 11. So that 2014 season seems like such an outlier. And it's really unfortunate, because again, he was very fun to watch that year when he was walking nobody, and he posted a career best strikeout rate as a starter over a full season. And it's disappointing anytime anyone gets injured, but it's particularly disappointing because the Twins don't have a ton of rotation depth. And I like, again, it's the same thing with Arizona. I like when these teams just sort of pop up and are competitive, and losing Hughes and having to bring up, whomever they bring up, whether it's Nick DePeche or whomever, it's a downgrade and it's unfortunate. So hopefully Phil gets back soon, and hopefully he performs better, because he's still got a few more seasons left on that contract. And this is not what the Twins had in mind when they signed him to that extension.
Would you say that that extension was a huge mistake?
Okay, Sean, give us the next move.
So Phil Hughes was born one day after me, and he's hurt and not a very effective pitcher anymore. So it really bums me out. I'm sorry that this is becoming like a podcast centered around my age, but these old-ish and broken pitchers, man, really bums you out.
Mega's having an existential crisis, and that can only mean one thing. We're nearing the Mets part of the show. Am I right, Sean?
Oh, you know it. Oh, it's that part of the show. So the Mets news today, we could probably just make this a segment every week. Hansel Robles was optioned to the minor leagues, and Josh Smoker was called up. The interesting thing is twofold here. This means that Rafael Montero lives another day for some unbeknownst reason to anybody anywhere near Mets fandom or Mets whatever you call it. But also,
It's appropriate here for the Mets.
Josh Smoker, who pitched an inning tonight, is slated to start or rumored to start on Saturday. So a Josh Smoker start in this Mets rotation that at the beginning of the year was supposed to be the best in the National League, had the most hype of any rotation.
Yeah, I mean, it's not good. And in Rafael Montero's defense, okay, not in his defense, but I remember a few springs back, I turned on a Mets spring training game to watch Rafael Montero, because back then he was, one of their top prospects and well thought of and all. And I remember DeGrom checked into that game in relief. And I remember being like, who is this? He was, older than Montero by a few years and didn't have nearly the hype. And, this really has nothing at all to do with Montero, which I suppose is apt, but Josh Smoker starting, I have to assume this is going to be like a bullpen game situation where Smoker goes two innings, maybe one time through the order, and then they go to the next reliever. I cannot imagine they're going to run out Josh Smoker, who has a 7.88 ERA. He's walked 5.6 per nine this season. He's given up nearly two home runs per nine this season. I can't imagine they actually envisioned him going four, five, six innings. So I'm going to assume that he will be the starter in a game, perhaps just to trick the other team into starting a bunch of righties, and then, turn it over to whomever from there. But yeah, it's not a good situation, and I would love to do my best Brian impersonation here, but I don't have that good of a voice, and I don't have the kind of angst that accumulates over a lifetime of Mets fandom. So I'm going to turn it over to Meg, who seems to have plenty of baseball-related angst. So let them have it, Meg.
I think that we should start to play a game where we sort of keep track of the pitchers who cycle through the Mets and the Mariners, bullpens and starting rotations, and it sort of make people guess which of them are real, because I'm not wholly convinced that these teams are not putting sort of folks off the street, maybe cobblers of shoes, youth pastors, just
End of
there
days is near, yes.
because you gotta you can't, I mean, you can't forfeit these games. That would be ridiculous. That'd be crazy. So you gotta put somebody out there. It's weird because, like, on the one hand, you want to hold people responsible for the rosters they construct, and this is not true of the Mets in this way. They are sort of diametrically opposed from the Mariners, but, like, you look at the Mariners, and we had, as analysts, as fans, as people who watch baseball, we had questions about the rotation going in. But we also have to acknowledge that, like, any team that loses 4 out of 5 starters is going to be pretty bad at baseball unless they have incredible depth in the high minors. And I think you look at the Mets and they're doing a lot of really weird head scratchy stuff, and you wonder why they're starting who they're starting. And I agree, like, Josh Smoker starting a game for the Mets and actually getting meaningful innings in that game just sounds like somebody who's trying too hard at a joke. I mean, like, that name, come on. Mets Twitter's gonna go crazy with puns on the day that that guy starts. But on the other hand, it's like you look at this team and you think about who's hurt, and it's not wholly surprising that they're having to resort to nonsense that they probably wouldn't have even considered a couple of months ago. I think it's more of a surprise to them and their fan base, just given how mighty we thought that rotation was gonna be. But I don't know, when your number five starter becomes your number one starter, you're calling up random dudes every couple of days because you're having to max out bullpens to sort of get through a game. I don't know. Stuff gets really weird really fast.
That's the best tagline for this Mets team that I can think
Yeah.
of. Stuff got really weird really fast. So I
At least they've
think
been to the postseason recently.
that's Meg's, not only is Meg having a personal existential crisis, she's having a baseball fandom existential crisis. Meg's like one step away from like just going
No,
off. She's one step away from the deep end.
I still have fond memories. I still love the Mariners, you guys. It's fine. They'll be good someday, or I'll be one of those, like, really old people that gets to watch their team win a World Series, and then I just get to be a monster because I'll be like 90. There are no bad options here. We all get to watch baseball. It's fine.
So I have one more question for y'all. Which is higher for Rafael Montero? His K9, his walk rate per nine, or his ERA with 7 being the flat line? The lowest of these three is 7.56.
Holy crap, really?
Yeah.
I already know the answer, so Meg, you guess which is the highest
Oh,
one.
God, I don't know. Walk rate? That's so mean.
That
That's
is the
mean.
lowest. He has an 8.64 K9, a 7.56 walk 9,
That's
and an
insane.
8.1 ERA. And it's not like this has happened in a vacuum. Last season, 9.47 K9, 7.58 walk per 9, and an 8.05 ERA.
Rafael Montero, everyone. Sean is not a
Wow.
fan, if you couldn't tell.
That's like, I mean, walking a lot of guys is, I
Not
don't know.
good.
It's not, I mean, it's objectively not good, but when you think about fan experience, I mean, really, really slow pitching is probably the only thing that's worse than that. And they often go hand in hand, right? Because then
Yes.
you get slowed down. But that's gotta be, that's like early 2016 Mariners bullpen nonsense.
It always comes back to a Mariners disappointment here, doesn't
Well, some things are
it?
consistent.
Misery loves company, misery loves the Mariners.
Yeah.
So we have reached the conclusion of this episode. I want to thank you, Meg, for coming on and joining in the tomfoolery and hijinks. And of course, Sean is here literally every episode. He is the Iron Man of the podcast. And you can find Meg on Twitter. Meg, you want to tell them your handle, or do you want me to just pronounce it me growler?
You can find me on Twitter at Meg Rowler, and you can find my work at Baseball Prospectus.
And with Sean, do you want to tell the individuals out there who want to know all about your cat where they can find you and Elliot online?
I think just saying Sean is here is probably the best way to tag me in, but at Sean Brody on Twitter.
And I am RJ Anderson, and we want to thank you for your continued support. And please come back soon, Brian. Please.
The puns will continue until you come back.
The puns will continue until morale improves.
Yeah, exactly.